This is a recording of a service at Forest Primitive Baptist Church, March the 23rd, 1985, preaching by Elder Sonny Piles.
We're thankful to be able to meet in God's house tonight. We ask sincere interest in your prayers as we engage once again in the service of God. I've always dreaded preaching to the Lord's people on Saturday night. It's my practice to preach meetings like this the year round. I've been doing this for most of my life. But sometimes we have a little difficulty, especially on Saturday night, having the attention of the Lord's people having their prayers. And I recall a few years ago I was helping vacuum my home church. And sometimes people say to me, as mean as you are, I suppose you run your home church. Well, sometimes they let me run the lawnmower and the vacuum cleaner. But I was helping vacuum my home church a few years ago, and back in the back where the young people usually congregate, I picked up a note, and I've still got it at home, and I suppose I'll keep it as long as I live. One youngster back there had passed a note to the other one saying, "You better straighten up," said, "Brother Sonny's watching you, and he sees everything." And I do. I see everything goes on. Sometimes people think that a preacher standing up here is in some kind of a bubble. You know, that he's in some kind of a little space capsule or a bubble, all spaced out and unaware of what's going on in the congregation. But I'm aware of what's going on. I see everybody comes in, everybody goes out. I sometimes see young men in the congregation more interested in the young lady beside him than he is in what I'm saying. I don't much blame him, because back when I was 15, 16, 17, I was usually more interested in the young ladies next to me than the preachers in the pulpit. And I hear babies cry. I watch people looking at their watches. I notice everything. Sometimes it's a handicap. I have a preacher friend in Texas who's blind. He's one of the ablest preachers in our state. And I've often envied him. I don't want to be blind, but I have envied him. Because he's not aware if he's preaching to 25 people or 100. And he's not aware if they're asleep, or he's not aware of what the young folks are doing, or anything like that. Frowns, things he says, don't bother him. And sometimes I see too much. And this brother gets up and he has total concentration on what he's saying. And that's one reason he's a very able and outstanding preacher. Has none of the distractions that I have. So we ask a real interest in your prayers. I realize it's Saturday night. We've been having meeting here since Wednesday night. And this is the second service I've been in today. So I want to ask a real interest in your prayers. I look at the 11th chapter of Hebrews in verse 4. And the Bible tells us of a man that lived several thousand years ago, and it says, "By faith Abel offered up unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain." And he says, "By which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts, and by it he being dead yet speaketh." And there's a lot in that text that needs to be preached, but the part I especially want to deal with tonight is that the Apostle Paul speaks here of a man that had been dead at least 4,000 years at his time. At the time Paul wrote this, Abel had been dead at least 4,000 years, perhaps much longer. But if Usher's biblical chronology is anywhere near correct, or the estimates that we can obtain by doing some chronologies ourselves on the Old Testament scriptures, the Apostle Paul looks back at a man that had been dead over 4,000 years, and he says, "Abel still speaks." And I want to try to talk to you tonight about how dead people speak. And I have no reference to going to witches or mediums or people like that that will put you into some kind of a seance and bring up your dead grandfather, your departed grandmother, anything like that. Because all such as that is abomination in the sight of God. And a lot of young people are not aware of this. But the Bible expressly condemns witchcraft in all of its forms. The Bible condemns palm reading. God's people should be psalm readers instead of palm readers. And the Bible condemns communication with the dead, Ouija boards, tarot cards, and all that type of mess. But I want to talk to you tonight about how dead people speak. This says, "By faith Abel offered up unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain." And we raise the question, what is faith? And it's taught by some outstanding people in the denominational world that faith is man's response to the gospel. I've had deans of seminaries and professors in theology schools give me that very definition of faith. Well, if faith is man's response to the gospel, my question is, who preached the gospel to Abel? Faith is not man's response to the gospel. That is not the Bible definition of faith. Galatians 5:22, chapter 5, verse 22, tells us that faith is one of those ninefold fruit of the Spirit. And wherever you find people doing anything by the Spirit of God, you find those people doing those things by faith. By faith, Abel offered up unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain. Now, this man Abel made this sacrifice to God by faith over 4,000 years before the Apostle Paul penned these words, because he was led and directed by the Spirit of God. Now, the Bible also tells us of an offering that was made by his brother. But let's notice the difference and the attitude and reception that the offering of Cain received and the offering of Abel. And you might say, well, I read that myself not too many days ago. I remember reading over there where it says that the Lord had respect to Abel's offering, but he did not have respect to Cain's offering. But it says more than that. If you go to Genesis chapter 4, verses 4 and 5, the text says, and to Abel and to his offering the Lord had respect. That not only says that the Lord respected Abel's offering, but he respected the man that made the offering. And it says there that he respected the man before he respected the offering. And to Abel and to his offering the Lord had respect. But to Cain and to his offering the Lord had not respect. That says that the Lord not only disrespected or had no respect for Cain's offering, and it says it had no respect, he had no respect for Cain himself. And to Abel and to his offering the Lord had respect. But to Cain and to his offering the Lord had not respect. Now we notice that when Abel brought this offering before the Lord, Abel brought an offering that required the shedding of blood, because he brought the firstlings of the flock and the fat thereof. In order to offer the fat of that lamb, it is necessary to put the lamb to death. Abel had his eye by faith on the blood of the Lord Jesus Christ that would be shed many centuries later. On the other hand, Cain comes forward with his fruit stand religion. He brings there the fruit of the ground. And there's an old saying that you can't get blood out of a turnip. I don't know that he offered turnips. I don't know what he offered. But he offered the fruit of the ground, but it had no blood in it. Now, Abel here has his eye on the blood of the Lord Jesus Christ, and the Lord was pleased with that offering. And it says, by faith Abel offered up unto God, or offered unto God, a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, by which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts, and by it he being dead yet speaketh. The writer says here that over 4,000 years after Abel did this thing by faith that was honoring and pleasing to God, he says Abel still speaks. By it he being dead yet speaketh. Now you say, well, how was Abel speaking? Abel was not speaking in the form of a witch or some kind of ghost or spook that was going around speaking to people in communication like some of the witches and people of this world who claim to have seances with the dead. He was not speaking in that sense. But the fact that Abel's offering was recorded in the Scriptures, and it still stands as a witness and testimony to God's people. It was a witness and testimony to God's people at the time the Apostle Paul wrote it. And it's a testimony to us today, because I draw strength and encouragement every time I go to Genesis chapter 4 and I read of the offering of Abel. When I think of a man before any gospel church was ever set up, before the Lord ever gave any law from Sinai, and I think of a man there that could do something that was pleasing in the sight of God without the aid of a gospel minister, without the aid of the rituals of the law, yet this man by faith could be directed by the Spirit of God to please the Lord. Now then, Abel continues to speak. Every time we read of Abel's example and we get a blessing or instruction from it, it's still speaking to us today. He says, and by it he being dead yet speaketh. And if God will be my helper and I can have your prayerful attention, I want to try to show you some ways that unless the Lord Jesus Christ comes back before you leave this world, that after you're dead and gone, that you will still speak. Every person here tonight, every man, woman, boy, or girl, unless the Lord comes back before you breathe your last, you will be speaking after you're dead and gone. This says that the dead man Abel, gone from this world over 4,000 years at the time this verse was written, that he was still speaking. Dead people speak after they've left this world. They don't come back to this world and rattle chains around windows or whisper into people's ears. But dead people speak through the influences that they have in their lives and memories of those that follow them. One of the most interesting things I've read in the last 20 years was a booklet I read not too many years ago, written by a very intelligent man. And his theme there was about seven men that rule the world from the grave. And truly enough, there are men that have been dead, some of them even for centuries, some of them not quite so long, that are ruling the world from the grave. I want to talk to you right now about a few men that are dead, They've been in the grave for years and years, but they rule the world from the grave. Then I've seen a few examples among God's people where men rule the church from the grave. People speak after they're dead and gone. We think of the world in which we live today, and the thinking in the public schools, our thinking from an educational standpoint, from a political standpoint, a religious and moral standpoint, has largely been determined by men who are not with us. Many of them have been dead for decades. I think, first of all, of a German Jewish Mason, and perhaps you're not offended at me being that plain, and if you find that remark offensive, just build yourself a fence around it because it's a historical truth. There was a German Jew one time, a great leader in the secret societies in his day, by the name of Karl Marx. You ever hear of him? There's a German Jew, a high-ranking member of the secret societies of his day, named Karl Marx. And that man in his demented, tormented mind, and he was a shiftless bum, didn't care for his own family, Karl Marx wrote a thing called the Communist Manifesto. That Communist Manifesto caught the attention of some later men named Lenin and Trotsky, and you've undoubtedly heard of them. And if you haven't heard of them, perhaps you've heard of Stalin and Khrushchev and some of the folks that are more modern, lived in later days. There was a man named Karl Marx, had an ally named Engels, and these German Jews got together and they wrote a thing called the Communist Manifesto. And the things that they wrote there, now you see, these men are dead. They've been dead for decades. But the things that they wrote there have changed the entire map of the modern world. They wrote the Communist Manifesto, which influenced a great revolution in Soviet Russia in 1917 and 18, and set up a communist empire, which later engulfed the Chinese and has engulfed Eastern Europe and a good portion of the world. Today, about a third of the world's people, perhaps more than that, if all the facts were known, at least a third of the world's people today are under the bondage of communism and slavery because the political thinking of about a third of the world's population today is ruled and dominated by men that are in the graves. Now then, the rest of the world, the so-called United States of America and her mama England and the nations of the European common market and the other parts of the earth have been forced to reshape their political thinking and their political policies because of a terrible, ominous threat of communism. So we might say the entire political face of the world today is ruled and dominated by some thoughts and some seeds that were put in writing by some men that are in their graves, yet they rule the world from the grave. The world politically is ruled by some dead men who are still speaking. Marx and Engels still speak today. They're dead, but they still speak. Mao Zedong is dead and gone, but the Chinese by the thousands still read his little red book. He's dead and gone, but his thinking and what he said dominates about a fourth of the world's population. Now think of another man ruling the world from the grave. There's a man in England once upon a time named Charles Darwin. You ever hear of Charlie Darwin? You say, oh, I remember Charles Darwin, the great English scientist. Well, you go back, better go back and do your homework. Every once in a while, folks will say, well, you know, you preachers don't have any business getting out here fooling around in science because, after all, you're preachers. You're supposed to deal with theology and let the scientists deal with science and you preachers deal with theology. The only college degree that Charles Darwin ever had was not in science. The only college degree he ever had was in theology. The only formal training he ever had was in theology. Now, I want to show you something right here. If a man whose the only formal training he ever had was in theology could get over here and meddle in the world of science and train and warp the thinking of scientists today, then I, as a preacher of the gospel, have got a right to get over there and meddle with it and try to straighten them out. I spent a number of years sending my youngsters to school. They've worked going to school, tried to pay their own way, but, you know, Pop has to support them a little bit. And I have a son, been in school about 9 years. My daughter spent about 5.5 years in school. And after sending my children a total of about 14.5 years to a modern brain laundry, commonly known as a college, I think I'm qualified to make a few statements. Now then, listen. We notice that the world of science today is largely dominated by the thinking of a man named Charles F. Darwin. Charles F. Darwin was really a preacher. Well, that was where his training was. I never heard him preach, but that's where his training was. His training was in the field of theology. Charles F. Darwin set out to prove something a long time ago. You say he set out to prove the theory of evolution. No, he didn't. You better go back and read his writings again. I've read most everything Darwin ever wrote. Darwin didn't set out to prove the theory of evolution. Darwin set out to prove natural selection and the survival of the fittest. And if you read his writings right carefully, he did a good job in proving natural selection or the survival of the fittest. But he never did prove the spontaneous generation of life, that life starts from nothing. He never did. I've got a little poem I used to tell my children. I've told it to a few classes where I've been speaking, spoke baccalaureate sermons. And I try to tell it to people wherever I go. The old atheistic professor stood up before his class one time and told them his life history, told them all of his roots. He says, I once was a tadpole, long and thin. Then I was a froggy with my tail tucked in. Then I was a monkey in a banyan tree. And now at last I'm a doctor with a PhD. Tadpole, froggy, monkey man, all glory to nothing for the planless plan. All right, his glory was given to nothing because according to him, he spontaneously generated from nothing. And when I was in school a number of years ago, one of the proofs that they used to give us that life can spontaneously generate itself, just start all by itself, and I hate to be so gross, as my daughter puts it, but the purpose of language is to communicate. One of the proofs they used to present us years ago was that you take a piece of meat and leave it out here, and maggots will spontaneously develop in it, you know, and turn into flies. That is, the maggots will develop in it spontaneously. Life spontaneously starts. But if you'll take that piece of meat and leave it covered where the flies can't get in there and put their eggs in it, you won't have any maggots in it. Those things did not spontaneously generate. They came from something else. There were a lot of foolish proofs they used when I was a youngster. Won't stand up anymore. I was in a class as a freshman a number of years ago. Ungodly, atheistic, rock-headed professor stood up before us one time. And he was making fun of the Genesis account of creation and Noah's flood, the flood in Noah's day. You ever wonder why the Apostle Peter tells us in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 1? Now notice this. The Apostle Peter in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 1, he said, this second epistle, he said, I'm writing unto you to stir up your pure minds by way of remembrance. He says, I'm writing this to stir up the pure mind. And I especially want you to notice what I'm trying to say right here at this point. If you don't take another thing home with you tonight, here's something that every preacher of the gospel in the United States of America needs to wake up to. The later generations of people who will be living just before the Lord comes back will need a preaching that will stir up the pure mind. The Apostle Peter tells these people in his other epistle, he says to gird up the loins of your pure mind. Peter, in both of those epistles, makes reference to teaching and preaching in such a way that it stirs up the pure mind. Now he says, I'm writing this second epistle to you, just like I did that former epistle. And he says, in both of them, he said, my purpose is to stir up your pure mind. There was a time when God's people could survive and get by on a preaching that just stirred up the emotions. There was a time when God's people could survive and get by on preaching that just stirred up sentimentality. And I'll be very frank with you tonight, very frank, and I don't know why I'm being so brutal here on Saturday night. Maybe it's because I don't like to preach on Saturday night, but pray for me. When I joined the church a number of years ago, joined the church about 33 years ago, I don't say this to be critical of the brethren that were preaching back then. I trust they were sincere. But many of the men back in that day saw no obligation to teach and establish the great things of the Scriptures. As long as we went to a meeting and everybody got all stirred up and we had a Primitive Baptist pep rally and we didn't learn anything and everybody got real happy and emotionally stirred up, well, folks were satisfied. They won't do it anymore. We're out here in a tough world. Your children are in danger. There's things in the world every day trying to influence them, trying to influence all of us. The only type of preaching that will meet the needs of the people of this day is a preaching that stirs up the pure mind. Now, I didn't say a preaching that just stirs up the intellect. I'm not talking about a type of preaching that is a cold, dead, intellectual lecture that just stirs up the intellect. I'm not talking about a type of preaching that just stirs up the reasoning. I'm talking about a type of preaching that stirs up the pure mind. The pure mind wants to learn, and the pure mind wants to feel. And the pure mind, when it learns spiritual things and feels spiritual things, has been abundantly satisfied. But Peter writes these people here that are going to need their pure mind stirred up, not their sentiments, not their emotions, and not just the cold, dead intellect. But he says here that there shall arise in the last days scoffers walking after their own lust. And he says they'll be saying, where is the promise of his coming? For he says they will say that all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation, and this they're willfully or willingly ignorant of. They're willingly ignorant of two great facts. That by the word of God, the heavens were of old. They're willfully ignorant of the fact of the Genesis account of creation, that by the word of God, this world was created out of nothing like that. They're willingly ignorant of that. And he says they're ignorant of one other thing. That the world that then was being overflowed with water perished. He says there's two facts that the scoffers of the last days will hate and despise. One of them is the Genesis account of creation, that God spoke the world into existence like that, and then there was a time when God overflowed it. And I've told Primitive Baptist parents for about 20 years that if you have a great dread and fear of sending your children out into the educational jungle of this world, I suggest you do two things. One of them is anchor them down on what the Bible teaches about the Genesis account of the creation, and hold on to that over here, and anchor them down to what the Bible says about the flood over here. Get them established in those two things, and it'll be hard for somebody to confuse them. Because Peter says that's the two main things the scoffers are going to hate. That by the word of God the heavens were of old, and then that world that then was being overflowed with water perished. And as a young person, when I was right in the midst of the educational jungle, those were the two things that were attacked on every hand. The Genesis account of creation, and that God flooded this world in the sixth and seventh chapters of Genesis. I had a professor a number of years ago that was standing up one day spoofing the Genesis account of creation, and he says, Noah could not possibly have put all those animals in the ark. One redneck Arkansas boy asked the question, said, how big was the ark? He said, I don't know. Now, if you didn't catch the inconsistency of that, pray over it about 5 minutes. Maybe the Lord will reveal it to you. Now, suppose I never met you before in your life, and I walk up to you and I tell you, there's no way you could put all your family in a Volkswagen. You say, how many people are in my family? I said, I don't know. I mean, a lot of you young men tonight, I haven't the faintest idea if you're married or not. There's some of you back there, I suspect you're not. Well, you're acting, but I suspect you're not. But anyway, there's some of you young folks here. I'd be silly for me to walk up to that young man right there and tell him, there's no way, brother, you get all your family in a little Toyota. I don't even know if he's married. Here's a man made the blatant statement that it would have been impossible for Noah to got all those animals in the flood, in the ark. And then admitted he had no idea how big the ark was. Sort of ridiculous, isn't it? Another real good one I heard several years ago was this one. All right, ha, ha, ha. See, here's sea level down here where the oxygen's real thick. Now, if God flooded this world and that water rose up to the top of the highest mountains, in other words, if that water covered the Himalayas and covered the Rockies and covered those high mountains, we're getting up here to a point where the air is real thin. And those animals couldn't have lived up there in that thin air in the top of the Himalayas and the Rockies. Now, if you haven't caught that yet, you're real sleepy. And you really need to wake up if you haven't caught that. Because you see, when the flood started, watch this, when the flood started, sea levels down here. And as that water rises, sea level's still up here. And you see what I'm saying? Sea level went up with the water. And so when the floodwaters covered the top of the highest mountains, there was just as much oxygen up there as there had been down here because it pushed sea level up with it. But somebody tried to put that over on me a number of years ago. Now, if you haven't caught it, like I say, you're mighty dull. Mighty, mighty dull if you didn't catch that. Well, anyway, I didn't say that to be ugly, but I mean, did wake you up, didn't it? Now listen, this man named Charles Darwin, his thinking still dominates the world today. His thinking has warped, and some people say molded, I'm going to say warped, the thinking of many of a biology and botany professor, both on a high school and college level. Charlie Darwin's dead. But he's still ruling the world. He's still ruling the world. Somebody says, well, all scientists are evolutionists. No, they aren't. There's a lot of great and godly men I know that hold eminent degrees in science that believe in the Genesis account of the creation, that believe in the flood. Some of the brainiest men in this world believe that book just like I believe it. But Charlie Darwin is still speaking, even though he's been dead for centuries. Why? How's he speaking? Because his influence has lived on decade after decade after decade. There's another old German one time named Sigmund Freud. Sigmund Freud wrote a lot of things about the human ego, and he wrote a lot of things about self-control. And Sigmund Freud was the man that wrote the things that dominate modern psychiatry. He wrote about controlling the passions, controlling the will, and all that, and he had so little self-control himself that he died of cancer of the jaw from smoking too many cigars. Isn't that ridiculous? The chances are real good. I'm not condemning all psychiatrists. I'm condemning most of them. Most of those of you that know me real well know that for over 22 years I've been the parent of a handicapped child. I've coached Special Olympics. My daughter teaches special education. I've been very interested in things like I'm talking to you about right now. And in my lifetime of dealing with a lot of psychologists and psychiatrists and people like that, I stand up here tonight and I say in all kindness and all humility and with all the diplomacy I can put together, being as kind as I possibly can, that most of them are nuttier than their patients. That's as kind as I can put it. But every once in a while, you meet one that's got his head screwed on right. I'm not condemning all of them. I very distinctly remember a number of years ago sitting in the office of an old Jewish psychiatrist in Dallas, Texas. Had diplomas all over the wall. This old Jew sat there and talked to me a good while about handicapped children, how to help them and all this type of thing. This old Jew sat there and he said, Elder Piles, and he had quite a sense of humor. He said, why are you called an elder? He said, what does an elder do when an elder isn't eldering? You ever thought about that one? I said, well, when an elder isn't eldering, an elder does about the same things other folks do. When I'm not eldering, I change the oil in my car, mow my lawn, fix my wife's washing machine. I do a lot of things other people do when I'm not eldering. But anyway, the old man had quite a bit of wit. But anyway, in the conversation, and where he got real close to my heart, he said, Elder Powell, said, my approach to psychiatry is totally different to that of my colleagues. Said, modern psychiatry is based on Freud's idea that man is basically good. And in his lifetime, he's learned a bunch of taboos and no-nos and given a bunch of codes of ethics and all that. And that's got him all mixed up, and he can't sin and enjoy it because he's a victim of his conscience. And I said, where I was preaching this morning, that the reason people have problems is not because you're a victim of your conscience, it's because you're a violator of your conscience. But modern psychiatry teaches that the reason you cannot fornicate and enjoy it, or commit adultery and enjoy it, lie and enjoy it, steal and enjoy it, is because your parents and your pastors and that old black book, the Bible, gave you a bunch of hang-ups. You were taught a bunch of no-nos. And if you could ever get rid of those hang-ups and no-nos and get out here and find yourself, isn't that ridiculous? You meet people all the time about to crack up that'll say, I'm trying to find myself. You know, the Bible never did tell you to find yourself. The Bible tells you to lose yourself. The Bible tells you to deny yourself. You know, the happiest people I've ever met are people who have lost themselves, denying themselves, trying to serve other people. You find a mother over here that has lost herself in love for her children and love for her husband. You don't find women like that cracking up. I've got a question I want to ask some of you young folks. There's a high percentage of people in America today from 20 to about 40 years of age on tranquilizers, taking all kinds of nerve pills, going to psychiatrists, filling psychiatrists' money and all this. Nervous breakdowns, crack-ups are happening right and left here in the United States of America. How many of these old-timey mamas that had 9 children and a rub board and a wood stove and a rolling pin, and I could name some other things, but I'm too much of a gentleman. In other words, they didn't have indoor plumbing. They had to chop wood Cook on a wood stove, use a rub board and all that type of thing. How many of those old mamas you knew of that had six children, seven children, eight children, nine children, how many of them you ever hear of having nervous breakdowns? How about it? The answer is none of them. You know why? They didn't have time. My wife and I were in a hospital in Dallas one time, overheard a couple of old colored women over there talking. They were talking about somebody having a nervous breakdown. One old colored woman told the other one, says, I'm going to slow down one of these days and have me one of them. Now listen. There's a great point there. Sometimes people today with our microwave ovens, our hot and cold running water, hair dryers, all of our push-button devices, we've got too much time on our hands. Folks have got a lot of time to think. And when they get to thinking, they don't think right. You know, I went to school 4 years and got a degree in home economics, and here I am surrounded by the four walls. I've got to fulfill myself. I've got to find myself. Only four walls closing in on you are the four walls of your head. Isn't it awful to talk to people that way? Now then, listen. This old Jew went on to tell me, he said, my approach to psychiatry is based on this premise, that man is basically bad, and he needs some laws and controls by which to guide him. Brother, he's preaching the gospel to me. You know why he was talking that way? He was an Old Testament Jew that believed in the Word of God, an Old Testament Jew that had a biblical view of the nature of man. The reason a lot of people out here in the world cannot help you when you have problems, they can't help you. They don't have the right concept of your basic nature. You've got to know a person's basic nature in order to be able to help them. You've got to see them as they are. There's a man named Sigmund Freud, been dead for years, still ruling the thinking of a large portion of the psychiatric and community and the psychologists and people that are trying to help you with your mental problems. They're dead. They're still ruling the world from the grave. Let's bring in a man named Dewey. I'm not talking about Thomas E. Dewey, ran for president back in the 40s. I'm talking about a man named John Dewey. Been dead quite a while, far as I know. Helped shape, far as I know he's dead. Is he dead? Far as I know he is. What I'm talking about is. Helped shape the so-called public school system. I don't call it that anymore. It's the government school system. I have at home a copy of the official magazine or the official organ of the real string pullers, the real people that run the United States of America. In their official organ, in early 1954, this statement came out, that the American public school system is to become the breeding ground that will pave the way for the new race, the new religion, and the new way of life that is to dawn on the American people. That came out in their official organ. And I'd almost name it for you. Later that year, you have the Supreme Court decision, 1954, later that year, to desegregate the so-called public schools. All right, now notice. The man Dewey I'm talking about is gone. He's still ruling the world from the grave. Marx and Engels, Charlie Darwin, a lot of other people I could name, through the influence of their writings and teachings, they're dead, but they're still speaking. They're still speaking. Men are in chairs and in seats of learning all over the United States of America. Men stand in pulpits, and those dead men are still speaking through them. There was a time about 300 years ago, a little more than that, about 350 years ago, when the Dutch people were what would commonly be called Calvinistic. I'm not going to say they agreed with us on every point of doctrine, but they taught the basic 5 points of what people commonly call Calvinism. Now, by the way, the doctrine that I preach is not Calvinism. People call it that. It's not Calvinism. Somebody says, no, you Primitive Baptists are not Calvinist, you're hyper-Calvinist. Well, now, that word hyper, I understand that means above and beyond. You know, over and beyond. You know, you've got hypertension, you've got hypoglycemia, hyper. I understand when something's hyper, that it's sort of above and beyond. Now, if you want to call me a hyper-Calvinist in the sense that what I preach is above and beyond Calvinism, that's fine. Because what I preach is certainly above Calvinism, it's beyond Calvinism, and it's older than Calvinism. The doctrine I preach was preached by Christ and the apostles over 1,400 years before Calvin's mother ever pinned the first diaper on him. But at any rate, the people of Holland were basically a Calvinistic people. There was a scholar arose in our country years ago. His real name was Harmanson. But it was popular in that day that all scholars would take a Latin name. And so he decided that he would take the Latin name of Arminius or Arminius. Now Arminius or Arminius has been dead probably over 300 years, probably been dead 350 years. But he's still ruling a great portion of the theological world from his grave, still speaking from his grave. And you know, sometimes when Primitive Baptist preachers stand up here, and I'm as guilty as anybody else, or sometime in our conversation, we make reference to Arminians. We confuse people. They're not Arminians, they're Arminians. I used to have this old Greek friend, gone home to be of the Lord, native of the land, educated in their best universities. I was acquainted with him for a number of years. And back when I was about 19, 20, along in there, in my conversation with him, we had a lot of rich discussions of the Bible, disagreed on quite a few things. But I would occasionally, in my youth, I would refer to his theories as being Arminianism. And he told me one time, he said, I've been in America a number of years and I've met very few Arminians. Said, the way you speak of them must be plentiful. An Arminian is a native of Armenia. And he thought I was talking about natives of Armenia. And that taught me to be a little more clear about what I'm talking about. I'm talking about an Arminian. You know what we mean when we talk about an Arminian? Arminian doctrine, the so-called Arminian theory, it's not the Arminian theory. That's giving it too much credit. It's the Arminian hypothesis. I won't even call it a theory anymore. It doesn't have enough ground to it to be called a theory. It's just a hypothesis. In fact, it's not even a hypothesis. But at any rate, so when I refer sometimes to the Arminian fables, the Arminian theories out here, you know what I'm talking about? I'm talking about how that there was a man one time in Holland named Arminius that came out with his 5 points to oppose the so-called 5 points that some people call the tulip doctrine, total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, and preservation of the saints. He came out with his 5 points, which were free will, the free moral agency of man. Arminius, or Arminius, has been dead for years, but he's still speaking. If you want to hear him speak, turn on your radio in the morning. Turn on your television in the morning. He's still speaking. I don't suppose I'd have to go 3 blocks. I don't know this neighborhood all as well, but I'll say 6 blocks. I don't suppose I'd have to go 6 blocks from this meeting house in the morning to hear Arminius speak. Because he's speaking from pulpits all over the world. Dead men speak. This man Abel over here was speaking in a good way thousands of years after he'd been buried. But you're going to speak. If the Lord doesn't come back before you breathe your last, you're going to be speaking when you're dead. You'll be speaking. I'll talk to you about a few men that are ruling the world from the grave. Men that are dead, ruling our public school systems. The humanism that's eating up our public school systems today, a lot of that was formed in the minds of men who aren't living today. The political face of the world determined by men that are dead. The economic face of the world, scientific face of the world, determined by people that are gone. And the face of the world from a theological standpoint has been warped by men that are long gone. I've also noticed in my years among the Primitive Baptists and preaching for them in about 37 states, but sometimes dead men can rule the church from the grave. And that's got its good aspects, but it's also got its negative aspects. I've watched dead men rule the church from the grave. I've been in sections of the country where our people were afraid to allow a meeting to go over 3 days. I went up in the Northeast one time, and there's some people up there wanting me to come to one of the very oldest churches our people have. They want me to come there and preach a week. I went up there and preached a week. And at the end of that week, the pastor baptized 6 people, and I baptized 1 in a little Pennsylvania stream. We baptized 7 people at the end of that week. 6 by the pastor, 1 by me. The Lord blessed that meeting, and he blessed several meetings that were held in that country since. And people put me on the radio up there in that country. Been on the radio ever since. The Lord blessed that meeting. It went a week. The Lord blessed it. They were scared to death to have that meeting go a week because they had it in their minds that no meeting should go over 3 days. Did you know there was a time when a good portion of our people believed that? There's some folks still believe that. That it's just all but unscriptural for a meeting to last over 3 days. You know where a lot of that got started? About 100 and, let's see, this is 1985 if I'm not wrong, say about 150 years ago, a little bit less, about 150 years ago, there was a wave sweeping America. Now, I'm going to just be plain with you. There was sort of a, I'm going to call it kind of a Pentecostal, charismatic wave sweeping America in the early 1800s, where people of other orders were going into communities and they were having things called protracted meetings. And some people call this the New Awakening. It was sort of a fad thing that just went all across the colonies over the part of the United States that was settled back in that day. And these type of folk would go into a community and they'd start holding a meeting. And they'd just hold that meeting, they said, long as the Lord was there, long as they had any spirit, long as people were still joining. And those protracted meetings might go a week. And they'd just say, we're going to hold this meeting until the Lord shuts it down. And those meetings might go a week, they might go 2 weeks, they might go 3 weeks. And there was all kinds of fanaticism going on. Here was a bunch of fanaticism going on out here in the world, and our brethren were watching it. And I want to tell you one reason some of those meetings lasted as long as they did. Now, I'm not trying to blaspheme the works of God. I'm not trying to speak out against the Most High God. No, I am not. But when I was a youngster in the ranch country of southern Oklahoma, and then in my later years in the ranch country of the part of Texas where I live in, and talking to some real old gentlemen, and I've had some old gentlemen in North Alabama tell me the same thing. Apparently this was sort of true all over the country. And my dad's 83 years of age, and it seemed like the boys up in Arkansas did the same thing. I'm going to tell you one reason those protracted meetings kept going along as they did. Back in those days, see, they didn't have any television, no radio, you know, no VCRs at home, no Trivia Pursuit to play, not too much to do for entertainment. And so if something's going on down here in the community under a brush arbor, under a tent, everybody went. I remember when I was a youngster, right after World War II, the candidates would come out in the country where we lived and they'd have a candidate speaking. They'd have lemonade and all this type of thing. Everybody went. You know why we went? Because that's where other people were going to be. That's the only reason we went. Well, the candidates would be up there speaking, telling their lies and, you know, carrying on like that. Nobody paid them any mind. We were out there visiting their neighbors, you know, just having a good time. It was just people used to go where other people were. Okay, the big protracted meetings going on in the community. My dad used to go to them. You know why my dad went to them? You say, I thought he was an old Baptist. Yeah, I'm trying to tell you why he went to the protracted meeting. It was about the only place where you could go meet a lot of girls. So my dad and his buddies go down to the protracted meeting. They'd meet a bunch of girls there. After about a week, the preacher start hollering, if we don't get somebody saved tonight, somebody don't come down here tonight, we're going to shut this meeting down. I know some old Baptist brethren in North Alabama told me the same thing. I've been told this all over Texas, all over Oklahoma. If somebody don't come down here and get right, we're going to shut this meeting down. Well, those old country boys sitting back there, if they shut this meeting down, we can't spark these girls anymore. And some old country bumpkins go down there and carry on, you know, so that meeting go on, so they can spark the girls a little longer. I'm not saying all of them went on because of that. Some of you older fellas here look like you know what I'm talking about. Now then listen. Some of our brethren about 150 years ago saw that type of fanatical thing going on. And they gathered together and wrote a declaration. And they recommended that under those circumstances that no meeting go beyond 3 days. I've got a copy of it home. I can read it for you. I'm not condemning those brethren. In that particular day, under the circumstances under which they were living, this protracted meeting and this fanatical thing out here just sweeping the country, why, perhaps those brethren used wise judgment under those circumstances and saying, we want to make it clear to our neighbors that we're not wrapped up in that thing. And I'm quite certain that those brethren did not intend to cripple the Primitive Baptist Church for the next 100 years or 200 years or 300 years with the circumstances that they were fighting right then. I'm quite certain that they didn't. It was something they needed right then. Those men that made that recommendation in that day are all in the grave. But until recent times, I've still met Primitive Baptists think a meeting shouldn't go over 3 days. I can find you where the Apostle Paul went into the city of Corinth and preached there 18 months. There's as much scripture for running a meeting 18 months as there is running one 3 days. Sometimes dead men can rule the church from the grave. I've been in places where a certain church had met once a month on the second Sunday in every month, and they'd done that as far back as people remembered. There's a lot of interest in the church, say, today. You've got young married people, folks out here wanting to meet more often. And I'm not saying people ought to meet every Sunday just to be meeting every Sunday. I didn't say that. Somebody says, well, how often do you think churches ought to meet? As often as you can go up to the house of God with joy and gladness. I've watched people start meeting once a month, start meeting every Sunday, just be meeting every Sunday, and sometimes it gets mechanical and stale and monotonous, and I've watched churches go down meeting every Sunday. You need to meet as often as you can go up to the house of God with joy and gladness. Some of these folks that have got the idea that every Primitive Baptist church ought to meet every Sunday just to be meeting every Sunday, I've got something you can't whip. The Primitive Baptist church grew more meeting once a month than it ever grew in history. Our forefathers landed over here on the East Coast, and in no time they were all over the 13 colonies. And by the time of the Civil War, they were already way out in Texas. And most of that, I didn't say all of it, most of that was done on once a month meetings. Somebody says, are you saying we ought to go back to meeting once a month? No, I'm not. I'm saying we need to go back and study what they had back there that we've lost somewhere along the way. Just mechanically meeting every Sunday will not do it. I heard of a church a while back, been meeting once a month, and they were going to start meeting every Sunday, just be meeting every Sunday. Somebody asked me, he said, what do you think about that? I said, I think it'll be the difference between 12 dead meetings a year and 52 dead meetings a year. Isn't it ugly? Isn't it awful to talk that way? That's plain truth. It's a real plain truth. Now then, how often should churches meet? As often as you can go up to the house of God with joy and gladness. And if that's every Sunday, I rejoice. I rejoice for you. Now then, I've seen churches over the country that had met once a month, maybe as far back as anybody could remember. But there's a lot of interest. People wanting to meet. There are people wanting to meet more often, maybe twice a month. They're wanting to meet every Sunday. And the interest is there. People could go to that church every Sunday with joy and gladness. But brother, when that's brought up, it becomes a difficult thing. I could name you some places right now, I'm not going to, where it's a difficult situation right now. And people will oppose it. You know why they'll oppose it? Because in their minds, my daddy never went over once a month. My granddaddy never went over once a month. This church ain't never met over once a month. Somebody says, you shouldn't say ain't. Well, I'm just quoting folks. I'm quoting what some folks have said to me. We ain't never met over once a month. Why? You know what you're doing right there? The scripture doesn't say we should just meet once a month. What's telling you to meet once a month? Your dead ancestors that are in their graves. Dead ancestors are telling you that. Dead people ruling the church from the grave. A lot of ideas. I am not opposed to anything God's people teach or practice that can be supported by thus saith the Lord. And I thank God for the ancestors we had. But many times they were forced to do things under the conditions under which they lived. Those old brethren back yonder made a recommendation, no meeting go over 3 days, and that was a good recommendation under the circumstances under which they were living, and I respect their judgment. I wouldn't throw off on those men back there. They were great men, greater men than I'll ever be. There was a time in the frontier period when the churches began to move west, the churches had to meet once a month. Because there was a circuit rider preacher, as the people moved west, went here once a month and over there once a month, it had to be done. But my friends, the frontier period's over. It's over. As an old lazy fellow out in my country, got a lot of wit, I went up to him one day and I asked him, I said, what do you do for a living? He said, well, my granddaddy told me that if a man stayed home and protected his house from the Indians, that was enough. That's all I do. Well, now, back in granddaddy's day, that was doing your duty. Stay home, protect your place from the Indians. But I mean, I don't need to be staying home protecting my place from the Indians anymore. Now listen. Men can rule a church from the grave, and I want to get down now to something that's far more tragic. If people do not preach the doctrine of the Bible, if we cannot agree on the doctrine of the Bible, we cannot walk together. If we cannot agree on the practice and what the Bible teaches, we can't walk together, because the Bible says, can two walk together except to be agreed? There are places where God's people have divided that they had an issue over which to divide. But I've also visited God's people in some areas of the country. I find some primitive Baptist churches over here. And as far as the doctrine and the practice and the behavior of the people, I couldn't tell one bit of difference than the folks over here. Why are you folks divided? We don't know. We've just always been divided. Why are you divided? You know why you're divided? Because your ancestors over here divided. Now, if you divided over a doctrine, that's different. If you've divided over practice, if you've divided over heresy, if you've divided over immoral conduct. I was reading a true story one time by some famous rodeo cowboys. They're still living, some of the leading stars in the rodeo world. This was a true story. These fellows wrote it themselves. A couple of these rodeo cowboys went to a place one time. There was a girl there, and they got in a fight over the girl, but they couldn't finish their fight. Because they started fighting, and the other cowboys jumped on them, pulled them apart, and they couldn't finish their fight. About a month later, they were in another state, and both of them came there to compete in a rodeo, and as soon as they saw each other, they started fighting. And there were always other boys around, and they pulled them apart. About 3 months later, they were up in Calgary, Canada, at the Calgary Stampede, rodeoing up there in Canada, and as soon as they saw each other out on the grounds, they started fighting. And some other boys pulled them apart. Later on, they were in a rodeo down in Wyoming, several months later. Soon as those two rodeo cowboys, living men today, top performers, soon as they saw each other, they started fighting. But there were always other people around to pull them apart, and they could never get their fight out. About a year and a half later, they met up at a place one time, and there's nobody out there but the two of them. And they fought, and they fought, and they fought, and they fought. One of them said, "I'm tired. Let's rest a while." And one of them sat down heaving for breath, and he said, "Larry," oh, nearly called the name. He said, "Larry," said, "what's the name? What's the name of that girl we're fighting over?" I said, "I don't know. I don't remember." I said, "Whoa." And they started laughing about it. They couldn't, either one of them, remember the name of the girl they're fighting over. All they knew was that any time they met, they were supposed to fight. And my dear friends, I have met some of the Lord's people in places that all they know is we're supposed to be fighting. We're not in fellowship. Why aren't you in fellowship? I don't have any idea. And when you start searching, it's because our great-grandfathers couldn't get along. You know what you've got right there? You've got great-grandfathers ruling the church from the grave. That's what you've got. Dead people keep on speaking. So far, and my time's about gone, I've talked to you about the negatives. I've talked to you about how dead men rule the world of politics. They rule the world of science. They rule the world of religion out here. And how dead men sometimes rule our churches in the wrong way. I'll spend the rest of my time tonight on the positive aspect of people speaking from their graves. This man Abel, it says, by faith Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, by which he obtained witness that he was righteous. And said, God bearing witness of his gifts, and says, by it he being dead yet speaketh. I read an example in the scriptures of some people, one of which perhaps was gone. And as time rolled on, I'm sure that the time came that both of these people were gone. I'm sure that the young man I want to bring before you lived on after them. We find the Apostle Paul wrote a young preacher named Timothy. Timothy is one of the most lovely characters of the New Testament. The Apostle Paul had a great love for this young preacher. He constantly wrote of his love for Timothy and how he was his son in the ministry. 2 Timothy chapter 1, verses 4, 5, and 6, the Apostle Paul says, "But I thank God when I call to remembrance the unfeigned faith that's in you, Timothy." He says this unfeigned faith or unpretended faith, he says, it dwelt first in your grandmother Lois and in your mother Eunice. The old British pronunciation's an IC. We'd call her Eunice. And he said, I am persuaded that in thee also. Young Timothy there is one of the most sterling characters of the New Testament. But I want to look at some of the things that influenced him. This young man was brought up in a home where he had a godly mother and a godly grandmother. Now his home wasn't a perfect home, because did you notice the Apostle Paul made no reference to the faith of Timothy's father? He never did say, I thank God for the faith of your father. Never did. Let's go to the 16th chapter of Acts and we'll get a little glimpse into Timothy's home life. And you may be sitting out there saying, well, my dad's wild and a march hare, my mother's a good member of the church, or it may be the other way around. And I don't have a perfect home like Timothy had. Timothy didn't have a perfect home either. Because we go to the 16th chapter of Acts, verse 1, and the Bible tells us that there was a certain disciple named Timotheus, another name for Timothy. It says his mother was a Jewish. She is a Jewish lady. His father was a Greek. You know what those Greeks were at that time? This is in Acts 16. The gospel has not been preached in a general way among the Greeks then. We're taught today to honor the Greeks. But let's study the Greeks for what they were spiritually at that time. This is in Acts 16. In Acts chapter 17, the Apostle Paul visits Greece. Those people knew so little about God, the truth about God, that they had erected outside of Athens, their capital, an altar to the unknown God. The Apostle Paul said that they were ignorant and superstitious. He says, you ignorantly worship this unknown God, says him declare I unto you. Those Greeks at that time, religiously speaking, were pagans. Not one thing is said about the faith of Timothy's father. You know what we've got here? We've got a home, first of all, that's divided according to nationality. You've got a Jewish woman marrying a Greek man. It's divided according to nationality. In the second place, probably divided according to religion. She was an Old Testament Jew. Her mother, Lois, was faithful in the Old Testament. And they were believers of the gospel. Notice this. His father over here is a Greek. Nothing said about his faith. It seems to me like that the burden of Timothy's spiritual upbringing was on the shoulders of his mother and his grandmother. The godly influence of his grandmother, the godly influence of his mother, continued to speak in the life of Timothy. It was showing up in the life of Timothy. The influence was carried on. Timothy had been taught the scriptures from the time he was a child, not because he'd ever been taken to a Sunday school. This was over 1,700 years before Robert Raikes ever invented the Sunday school. But he had known the scriptures from the time he was a child. Here's some people here that their lives were being passed on and reflected in the life of this outstanding young pastor in the first century. Now then, my dearly beloved friends, men keep on preaching after they're gone. I go into sections of the country today, and you can see the beneficial fruits of men that aren't living anymore. Men preach after they're dead. They keep on preaching. Not just through their tapes and their booklets and their writings. No, no, no. I go into sections of the country today where God's people are stable and sound in the doctrine. And I think about the men that are now resting in the silent city of the dead, whose souls and spirits are at home with the Lord. I think about men that I never met on this earth and will never meet on this earth. I expect to meet them in glory, but I'll never meet them here on this earth. That their preaching is living on. I can also think of some others that taught heresies and false doctrine. Their preaching's living on too. My country, my section of the country, suffered for decades because of the seed that was sowed by a man named Daniel Parker and his followers. There've been seed sown in this country and on up the East Coast here by men that are dead and gone. Our people suffered from it. Every man preaching the gospel today, if this world continues, will preach on after he's gone, because he will influence the generation of people that heard him, and they're going to influence the next generation. And then a third or fourth generation that never knew that man face to face will be influenced by what he taught. That's kind of a chilling thought to me. That fills my poor heart with fear to think that I may be influencing people today and maybe influencing them in the wrong way, who will influence other people, who will influence other people after I've left these shores. Not only from the standpoint of a gospel preacher, but every mother here, you're going to influence folks. You say, well, I may just have a little family of two or three. Yes, but in that little family of two or three, you may influence a man that may someday preach to thousands and thousands of people. You might influence a man here that might someday be a senator or a governor. You might influence a man that might be in a university someday and influence thousands. The influence that you're having at home, Mom, might be the influence one of these days that might determine some decisions made in the White House. These things happen every day. These things happen every day. There's an old saying, never mistreat your paper boy. He may be your bank president one of these days. That little paper boy you're kicking around today, he might be president of the bank down there. Back when I was in high school as a fat kid in my class, nobody could stand him. Well, I didn't say that we couldn't stand him because he's fat. I shouldn't have put that in there. Well, anyway, there was a kid I went through high school with. Nobody could stand him, just to be frank with you. I'm broad-minded and tolerant. You've done figured out. But just nobody could stand him. This kid was smarty. He just, well, nobody liked him. And, you know, we used to just beat him up for exercise. Now, he'd tell you things like that. But he's now the assistant district attorney of Dallas County. That's right. I hope I never get in a jam in Dallas County. I sure do. Every time I'm down there, I'm on my P's and Q's, brother. I mean, if I'd have known back in those days he'd be the assistant DA of Dallas County, back when I was going through school with him, brother, I'd have bought him hamburgers and banana splits and all that. I may get in a jam down there someday, and if I ever do, my goose is cooked, you hear me? Now listen. Listen, my friends, every one of us is sowing seed. Every father, every mother here tonight, you say, well, now, wait a minute, that's not fair. It's not fair that the life I'm living could mold and shape and cripple the lives of future generations, but that's the way it is. You might say, well, my children are not guilty of my sins. Just a minute. There's a difference in guilt and consequences. You know, a lot of people don't turn the television off long enough to sit down and think much anymore. There's a difference in guilt and consequences. I could do things that are wrong. Now, sure, my children aren't guilty of them, but they'll bear the consequences of it. Some of you brethren or some of you sisters, young ladies tonight, I'll just use some of you brethren. Some of you brethren leave this meeting house tonight, go down here to a bar and get drunk, get in a fist fight, get two of your front teeth knocked out, and then be sorry for it, go back home and beg God to forgive you. I mean, beg God to forgive you. Dear Lord, I'm sorry I got drunk. I'm sorry I got in that fight. You beg God to forgive you. Undoubtedly, the Lord forgive you. You say, Lord, I'll never do something like that again. Undoubtedly, the Lord will forgive you. The Lord forgive you that, cleanse you of the guilt of that, but you'll bear the consequences of it as long as you live. That won't put your two front teeth back. I'm being real plain with you tonight. I guess it's the only way to keep people awake on Saturday night. I know men today, some of them are members of the church, that back when they were youngsters were alcoholics. And they quit drinking 40 and 50 years ago and have not touched a drop of liquor for over 40 years. I know some men today that quit drinking 20 years ago, haven't touched a drop of it in 20 years. Ask God to forgive them, and I don't have any doubt that the Lord has forgiven them. But some of those men today have got bad kidneys and bad nervous systems, and the physical effects of those things are still in their bodies. There's a difference in guilt and consequences. Yes, sir, you can be sorry you got that fight and got your teeth knocked out. Lord, forgive you the guilt of that thing, sure enough. Won't put your teeth back. He won't put your teeth back. The German people today are suffering. Little German boys and girls today are suffering the consequences of what Adolf Hitler did. Our children and our grandchildren are going to suffer the consequences. I'm not telling you God's going to just actually transfer the guilt over to them and all that. I'm not going to tell you that. That's God's business. But I'm going to tell you for sure that they're going to carry the consequences of what we're doing. It sort of frightens me. But if The world continues to live after I've left it, but I'll keep on preaching from my grave. That makes me want to preach right. Makes me want to live right. Makes me want to try to influence people right. It ought to make every mother here tonight want to be a better mother. Because you're going to keep on speaking after you're dead. Every child here tonight, man, woman, boy, or girl, if you live long enough to influence other people and you go the way of all the earth, you're going to speak from the grave. This man Abel's dead, yet he says he still speaks. I hope it's in a positive way. I hope I can keep on preaching in a positive way after my voice has been silenced. But there's one thing for sure. Our lives are going to keep on speaking. We're going to speak. How are we going to speak? I hope we can speak like Abel did, in honor and glory to God. Thank you for your real good attention. May the Lord bless you.